Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to getting really well informed. Today, we're diving deep, really deep, into something fundamental, the cell membrane, how cells interact with, well, everything around them. And our guide for this journey is the work of Dr. Hoffman, specifically a couple of his really comprehensive lectures. They just lay out these core principles governing life at the, you know, the most basic cellular level.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because it seems like such a simple thing, just a boundary. But Dr. Hoffman really brings it home how incredibly dynamic these membranes are. They're not static at all. They're crucial for survival, letting nutrients in, sending signals out, maintaining shape, everything.
Okay, so let's start unpacking that. Where does Dr. Hoffman begin? The basic structure.
Exactly. He starts with the absolute foundation. The phospholipid bilayer.
Another layer.
And the fascinating thing is why it even forms. It's spontaneous. It all comes down to the phospholipids themselves being amphipathic.
Amphipathic, okay. Meaning they kind of have two different personalities.
Precisely. You've got the head part polar, contains phosphate, it loves water.
Yeah.
Hydrophilic. Then you have the tail's non-polar hydrocarbons, they hate water.
Yeah.
Hydrophobic. So you put them in water and what happens? They automatically arrange themselves, heads out towards the water. Tails tucked inside, away from it, creates that double layer, the bilayer. It's ingenious, really.
But just lipids aren't enough for a working cell.
Yeah.
It needs more functionality. This is where Dr. Hoffman brings in the proteins, and it gets really interesting.
Yes, exactly. And he makes a key point. These proteins aren't, like, chemically glued to the lipids. And the lipids aren't glued to each other either. They're all independent. They can slip past each other, swap places. It's very fluid.
Like molecules milling around in a crowd.
Sort of. He uses this great analogy. The proteins are like buoys floating in a sea of phospholipids. They stay embedded because parts of the protein are hydrophobic, happy among the lipid tails, and other parts are hydrophilic, sticking out towards the water. Stable, yet movable.
Which leads right into the fluid mosaic model, doesn't it?
It does. Dr. Hoffman describes the membrane as both fluid, it can flow and bend, and a mosaic made of all these different pieces, the lipids and proteins, constantly shifting around.
And how fluid are we talking?
Amazingly fluid. The phospholipids, they move sideways, laterally, about 10 million times per second. It's incredibly fast. He paints this picture like a huge mass of people on New Year's Eve in Times Square, just constant motion within each layer.
Wow. But they don't flip-flop between layers very often.
Much, much rarer. Think about it. That hydrophilic head would have to travel through the hydrophobic core. It doesn't want to do that. So, sideways shuffling, yes. Flipping, not so much. And this fluidity is vital. Allows membranes to fuse, let cells change shape, respond to stress.
Okay, that model sounds compelling.
Yeah.
But how do we actually know it's true? What's the evidence Dr. Hoffman points to?
He gives a couple of really neat examples. One is freeze fracturing. You freeze a membrane, crack it open.
Like splitting ice.
Yeah, basically. And when you look with an electron microscope, you see the inside faces of the two layers, and they're not identical. The inner layer usually has more proteins stuck to it, so there's an asymmetry, a polarity.
Interesting. What else?
The other one is just elegant, the mouse and human cell fusion experiment. They took mouse cell proteins, mark them, say, green, took human cell proteins, mark them red, then they fused the two cells into one big hybrid cell.
Okay. So if the membrane was rigid,
you'd expect the green proteins to stay on one half, the red on the other. But that's not what happened. After a little while, the green and red markers were completely mixed up, spread all over the hybrid cell surface. It's just clear visual proof that those proteins can and do move around. Fluid mosaic confirmed.
That's pretty definitive. So given this fluidity, how does a cell control it? Make it looser or tighter depending on, say, temperature?
Ugh, good question. And cells are masters at this. Dr. Hoffman explains they tweak the types of fatty acids in their phospholipids. If it gets warmer, membranes can get too fluid, almost leaky. So the cell uses more saturated fatty acids. Their tails are straight, so they pack together tightly, makes the membrane more viscous, tighter.
Like stacking bricks neatly.
Exactly. But if it gets cold, membranes can become too rigid, almost solid. So the cell incorporates unsaturated fatty acids. These have kinks in their tails because of double bonds. Those kinks prevent tight packing, creating space, making the membrane looser, more fluid, even in the cold.
Clever. And cholesterol plays a role, too.
Yes. Dr. Hoffman highlights cholesterol. It wedges itself between the phospholipids. It's kind of a fluidity buffer. At warmer temperatures, it restrains movement, makes it less fluid. Uh-huh. At cooler temperatures, it disrupts packing, makes it more fluid. Plus, it affects permeability, especially to small ions. It's a fine-tuning molecule.
Okay, so we have this fluid adjustable structure. Let's talk more about those proteins. Dr. Hoffman outlines, what, six major functions?
Yeah, it's like a multi-tool built into the membrane. First, transport. Obvious one. Proteins act as channels or carriers to get specific things across that can't just diffuse through the lipids.
Like selective gates?
Precisely. Second, enzymatic activity. Some membrane proteins are enzymes speeding up reactions right there at the membrane surface. Very efficient. Third, signal transduction. This is huge. A molecule outside, maybe a hormone, binds to a receptor protein. That protein then relays the message inside the cell, causing some change. Dr. Hoffman stresses these have to span the membrane, transmembrane proteins, to pass the signal along. The signal molecule itself might never enter.
So the protein acts like a doorbell and an intercom.
Good analogy. Fourth, cell-to-cell recognition. Proteins with carbohydrate chains attached act like ID tags. Let cells recognize each other, important for tissues, immune system. Distinguishing self from non-self. Fifth, intercellular joining. Proteins that link cells together, like rivets or zippers, think desmosomes or tight junctions holding tissues together. And finally, sixth, attachment to the cytoskeleton and extracellular matrix, anchoring the membrane to the cell's internal skeleton and the external support network, gives the cell shape stability.
That's an incredible range of jobs for these embedded proteins. So how do they get there? How does a cell add new proteins to its membrane?
It's a fascinating process, Dr. Hoffman describes. It starts back in the cell's protein factory, the rough ER, and then the Golgi apparatus. Proteins destined for the membrane get embedded in the membrane of vesicles, little transport bubbles, as they move through these organelles. These vesicles then travel to the plasma membrane and fuse with it.
And when they fuse?
Their membrane becomes part of the plasma membrane, and the proteins they were carrying are now integrated, facing the right way and everything. It's how cells can increase the number of specific receptors, for instance. Or decrease them. He mentions this is involved in things like drug tolerance. The cell might reduce receptors for a drug if it's constantly present.
A dynamic supply chain right within the cell. Okay, so the membrane is built. It's functional. Now, the big task, getting stuff in and out. Dr. Hoffman breaks down transport into three main types.
Yes, passive transport, active transport, and vesicular transport. And the key difference he really drills down on, especially between passive and active, is energy. Does it require extra energy input from the cell?
Passive doesn't, active does.
Exactly. Passive transport uses energy that's already, as he puts it, built into the system. Active transport needs an additional energy boost, usually from ATP.
What does it mean, energy built into the system?
Yeah.
Dr. Hoffman talked about gradients being key for passive transport.
Right. A gradient is just a difference between two places. Could be concentration, pressure, electrical charge. Think of a pile of sand, high concentration at the top, low at the bottom. That's a concentration gradient.
Oh.
In passive transport, particles naturally move down their gradient from high concentration to low. It's driven by the random movement of molecules, Brownian motion, but the net result is movement down the slope, so to speak, until things are evenly spread out. No extra push needed.
And there are different flavors of passive transport.
Two main ones, he clarifies. First, simple diffusion. This is for small, nonpolar molecules, things like oxygen, carbon dioxide. They can just dissolve in the lipid bilayer and pass right through, driven only by their concentration gradient. Simple as that.
Needs a gradient, needs to be able to get through the lipids.
Got it. Then there's facilitated diffusion. This is for molecules that are, as he says, either too large or too polar or both. They can't just slip through the lipids. So they need help. Transport proteins, either channels or carriers, provide a specific pathway. They facilitate the crossing, but crucially, it's still passive, still moving down the concentration gradient. The protein just helps it happen, and different substances move independently down their own gradients.
Okay, and then there's that really important special case, osmosis. That always seems trippier.
It trips people up. Yeah. Dr. Hoffman defines it very clearly. Osmosis is specifically the diffusion of solvent, and in biology, that's basically always water, across a selectively permeable membrane, meaning the membrane lets water through, but not certain dissolved things, the solutes. Now, the confusion often comes because people say water moves from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, which sounds weird, right? Like moving uphill. But Dr. Hoffman points out that's just a backwards way of saying water moves from where water itself is more concentrated, meaning fewer solutes dissolved in it, to where water is less concentrated, more solutes. So water is still moving down its own water concentration gradient. It's just regular diffusion, but specifically for water across this special membrane. The YouTube experiment he likely mentioned shows this perfectly. Water moves to balance out the wateriness on both sides.
Okay, that clears it up. Water moves from more watery to less watery. Makes sense. Now let's flip to active transport, the energy guzzler.
Right. This is the opposite of passive. Active transport moves substances against their concentration gradient. From low concentration to high, that takes work, like pushing something uphill. So it always needs additional energy, usually ATP. And importantly, it always uses a carrier protein. Channels won't work for this. They just let things leak back down. These carriers are often called pumps.
Like a sump pump pushing water out of a basement. What examples does Dr. Hoffman use?
He talks about two main types. First, primary active transport. This uses energy, like from splitting ATP, directly to power the pump protein. The absolute classic example in us animals is the sodium-potassium pump. It pumps sodium ions out of the cell and potassium ions in. Both are moving against their respective gradients. There's already more sodium outside, more potassium inside.
That takes a lot of energy.
A staggering amount. Dr. Hoffman notes it accounts for maybe 40% of the reason you eat, just running that one pump system in all your cells. It's vital for nerves, muscles, maintaining cell volume. He also mentions proton pumps, which are critical in plants, fungi, bacteria, and even parts of our own bodies.
40%. Wow. Okay, what's the other type? Secondary active transport.
Yes, and this one, he says, confuses a lot of people. Because the pump itself doesn't directly split ATP at that moment. Instead, it uses the energy stored in a gradient that was already established by primary active transport.
So it's like using one pump's work to power another movement.
Exactly. His example is the sucrose proton co-transporter in plants. First, a primary pump using ATP pumps protons, H+, out of the cell, creating a steep proton gradient, lots of protons outside, few inside. Then, the secondary transporter lets protons flow back down their gradient into the cell. And as they flow through the transporter protein, it harnesses that downhill flow energy to simultaneously drag sucrose molecules into the cell against the sucrose gradient.
Like a water wheel using flowing water to grind grain.
Perfect analogy. The proton flow is the water turning the wheel. The sucrose transport is the grinding work being done. No direct ATP used here, but it relies on the gradients set up by ATP earlier. He also clarifies terms like uniporters, symporters, antiporters, describing if the pump moves one thing or two things in the same direction or two things in opposite directions, like the sodium-potassium pump, which is an antiporter.
And the third major category was vesicular transport, for the really big stuff.
All right, for moving bulk materials or very large molecules that can't possibly fit through a protein channel or pump. It involves wrapping the material in a membrane vesicle. Endocytosis brings things in. If it's engulfing solids, like a white blood cell eating bacteria, that's phagocytosis, cell eating. If it's taking in droplets of fluid, that's pinocytosis, cell drinking. There's also receptor-mediated endocytosis, which is very specific.
Mm-hmm.
Receptors on the surface bind to a target molecule, and then the vesicle forms, bringing in just that target. Very efficient.
And the reverse, getting stuff out?
That's exocytosis. Vesicles loaded with material inside the cell, maybe hormones, neurotransmitters, or waste, move to the plasma membrane, fuse with it, and release their contents outside.
So all these transport mechanisms are vital.
Yeah.
Which brings us to tonicity and how water movement via osmosis affects cells in different external environments.
Yes, and this is where Dr. Hoffman really hammers home a crucial point to avoid confusion. Tonicity terms, hypertonic, hypertonic, isotonic, they always describe the solution outside the cell, the environment, never the cell itself.
Okay, describe the environment relative to the cell.
Exactly. They're based on solute concentration, but they tell you about the relative wateriness and predict which way water will move by osmosis.
Right, so let's walk through them. What happens in a hypotonic environment?
Hypo means lower solute concentration outside than inside the cell. Therefore, the outside environment is more watery. So water rushes into the cell by osmosis. For an animal cell, like a red blood cell without a rigid wall, it swells up and can burst. That's called lysis.
Bad news for animal cells. What about plants?
Plant cells also take in water, and they swell. But their strong cell wall pushes back against the pressure. This internal pressure makes the cell firm, or turgid. And Dr. Hoffman explains this turgor pressure is actually the ideal state for most plant cells. It's what keeps plants standing upright. He also mentions protists in fresh water having contractile vacuoles to constantly pump out the excess water they absorb in their hypotonic world.
Okay, so hypotonic, water in. What about hypertonic?
Hyper means higher solute concentration outside than inside. So the environment is less watery than the cell. Water rushes out of the cell. Animal cells shrivel up. That's called crenation, also usually fatal. Plant cells also lose water. The plasma membrane pulls away from the cell wall as the cell contents shrink. That's plasmolysis, also fatal. Think wilting.
So hypo makes animal cells burst, hyper makes them shrivel, both bad. What's the Goldilocks zone?
That's the isotonic environment. Iso means same. Same solute concentration outside as inside. Therefore, the same wateriness, water moves in and out at the same rate. There's no net movement. For animal cells, this is perfect. Stable volume, happy cell. It's the state your body fluids aim to maintain homeostasis. For plant cells, it's okay. They survive, but they become flaccid or limp because there's no turgor pressure pushing against the wall. Not ideal for structural support.
It really highlights how critical that balance is, especially for animal cells without that rigid wall. This whole deep dive guided by Dr. Hoffman's lectures, it just paints such a vivid picture. The membrane isn't just a bag, it's this incredibly dynamic, complex, essential interface. Fluid, selective, communicative.
Absolutely. It controls everything that comes in, everything that goes out, how the cell senses its world, how it connects to others. It's fundamental.
So, reflecting on all this intricate machinery, the fluidity, the pumps, the gradients, the osmotic balance.
It does make you think, doesn't it? This raises an important question. We see how membranes underpin homeostasis in our bodies, how they let plants stand tall, how single cells survive. But what else depends on these delicate balances in ways we maybe haven't even considered? How might tweaking our understanding of these basic membrane principles lead to new breakthroughs, maybe in medicine or understanding diseases or even developing new technologies? There's still so much intricacy there.